and welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you very much for joining me today. As per usual, can you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Pauline Dawson, and I'm a midwife in Dunedin in New Zealand. I graduated as midwife in about 2002, and I'm currently working in research and education.
And you're a natural Kiwi too, by the accent.
Yeah, I'm from the deep south of Southland, and we have a special Southland accent, but I think I've lost it over the years. I don't roll my R's quite as much as I used to. But
that's right. Us Aussies over here on the ditch, we keep kind of paying you out with fish and chips and sticks.
I have a very Kiwi accent.
Which is cool, which is really cool. So what made you get into midwifery then? Let's start way at the beginning.
Right, well, I was a latecomer to midwifery. I think I was about 30, perhaps, mm-hmm. Something around there. When I left school, I went into telecommunications and engineering.
Wow.
And then I did some other things. I ran a cider company in a big international corporate IT company doing data work and networking. I decided it was a bit soulless.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out our company was a big provider to the US military, and I just thought, nah, I can't do this anymore. And I want to do something real. And for some reason, at the time, I was past Ina May Gaskin's book. And
yep.
I thought, that's real.
Absolutely.
I don't know. I didn't have children. I was single. I just thought, this is as real as it gets. I think it might have been through looking at Right Livelihood, mm-hmm. actually. So I went... and applied to midwifery school and got in, and as naive as they come. And I learnt an awful lot and loved it, and still love it. And so it's been a big career change for me, but love it. And still love it. And so it's been a big career change for me, but love it. And I will get to it, but things have sort of come around a bit full circle again because I'm working with data again now. So.
And it's interesting how world does that and how karma or life, you kind of think you've gone away from something and then suddenly it's like, oh, it's back, but in a new way.
Yeah.
So how exactly. What models of care did you work in after you finished your initial kind of graduation?
Well, I was absolutely privileged to work in a rural area as a student midwife, and I was invited to join that practice,
yep.
Which is in the North Island, and so I worked in remote rural, what we call LMC, lead maternity care. We do a continuity model here, so I just went straight into that in rural New Zealand, and a really interesting community, and it was great, incredibly challenging.
In what way?
Challenging in that I think remote rural, although in New Zealand remote rural is not the same as Australia, let's say,
yep.
Or Canada, or,
but you know. Relative, though.
It is relative. For us, it's like you're a few hours away from a hospital. Where I work now, I suppose, is probably 4 hours is the furthest you'd go. But, you know, it's not 20 minutes, you know. But I was used to that, and I really loved the community. It was a very high percentage of Māori, the Indigenous people of New Zealand. Quite a high deprivation, sadly, but a real community.
Mm-hmm.
And I was part of it, and... You know, the thing here with the continuity model is if you're available, somebody's available 24/7, and some of these little communities don't have medical or GP support. So the midwife's always on the phone. So you got some very strange calls at times because you're the only medical person that was going to pick up their phone at 3 a.m.
So how did you cope with that? Because some of those calls would have been outside the scope of midwifery.
Oh, absolutely.
So how did you upskill yourself, or what support did you have for those decisions?
I think, we had a really good group practice for a start as midwives, but we also had really good, strong relationships, communities of practice, really, with other professionals in the community, the district nurse, the GP. It came and went, but you have to, in those communities, you have to work together like that. Ambulance people, the primary hospital, the small local hospital. And where we were also have to work together like that. Ambulance people, the primary hospital, the small local hospital. And where we were also had quite poor coverage for mobile phones and pagers and things, and we all had to work together or else it would have been disaster. So, yeah, we just pulled together, and most of the time it was great.
That team collaboration, yeah.
Yeah, and to be honest, that's on reflection. It wasn't always like that at the time, and you don't know, you don't know what you're doing sometimes when you're actually in it, in the midst of it. I am Pākehā, New Zealand European, and I was chucked into a very high percentage of Māori population with a very strong tradition too, and I bumbled my way through that. I just cringe when I think about it now, but it was a very generous community.
Yeah.
And I felt welcomed and supported as well. So.
And I think that if you have that respect going in, then that's picked up, that they know you're genuine there. And so if you do kind of make an ass of yourself, or if you do kind of like unintentionally do the wrong thing, it's like, okay, we're going to help you along. And so.
Yeah, it wasn't always great because. The sad thing was that a lot of those people really wanted a Māori midwife and they just went anywhere. And sometimes they were stuck with me. And it's like I would go, okay, I know this isn't who you want, but this is how can we work with this?
Is that getting better?
It's getting much better, and the government's recently put a lot of money into specific programs to train Māori and Pacifica midwives, which is awesome and great, and it's so desperately needed. But this is a while ago, and I it's absolutely needed, and we don't want people like me bumbling their way through, really. It's so desperately needed, but this is a while ago, and I it's absolutely needed, and we don't want people like me bumbling their way through, really. It's not optimal.
No, we know we've got so much evidence to show the needs and the cultural care that's there that should be available. And yet we're still arguing for it. We're still fighting for funding. We're still fighting to get places. It seems ridiculous.
Yeah. And I owe that community such a debt for nurturing me, really. And my practice partners who'd worked there for a very long time. And they'd say you're okay, so therefore you were okay, and they were part of that community. So it was a pretty steep learning curve.
So how long did you stay there?
Oh, was it 5 or 6 years? And I had my own children, so I had to stop in the end with three under five.
Oh, wow.
I started doing some study at that point. I decided that I'd do my master's. Oh, no, I did a certificate of postgrad certificate, and then I thought I'd do my master's.
Because so what did you do your master's on?
I had a few false starts, and then I moved from that area. My husband had a job, so we moved back down south where my family's from. And I ended up doing my master's on where women chose to have their babies in a big rural area. Why women didn't choose their local primary unit, or why they did, or why they wanted to go to the big hospitals or not. And I specifically studied the area that I work in, which is about a third of the South Island, maybe a quarter of the South Island. It's a really big area. It's the biggest geographical health area in New Zealand, but it's quite a dispersed population. So I looked at tension of distance. Like, people actually wanted to stay close to home, but it was this tension between feeling safe and wanting to be close to home. I started using some of my IT skills then. I did some geographic information system work and some modelling, geographic modelling about predicting what people might do depending on where they lived in relation to the hospital. Like people don't, I found that people wouldn't tend to travel away from a secondary tertiary hospital, that people wouldn't travel away from a secondary tertiary hospital to go to a primary unit. But if they passed on one on the way from where they lived, they might stop.
Okay.
Yeah. So there was actually quite a short distance. It was 10 kilometres or something that they might travel away and then they just wouldn't do it. So there was a modelling component. You went to the town where your family was, or so that was my master's thesis, was examining those things, yeah.
So what was the surprising thing that came out of it for you?
I think the predictability, actually, yep. that you could use a mathematical formula, which is actually based on shopping behaviours.
Ah, that would be surprising.
Some of the formulas I used came from consumer-driven research.
Okay.
And it's like, how far would somebody travel to go to this shop compared to that shop, you know? Like, they'd go to a mall rather than a little shop. It's the same kind of thing. Or they'd go to the town where they could do lots of things rather than, yeah. So it surprised me how predictable it was.
That's human nature.
Yeah.
So, yeah, convenience versus the non-convenience.
Yeah, it was.
That's human nature.
Yeah.
So, yeah, convenience versus the non-convenience.
Yeah. And I wasn't surprised that the biggest decision-making was where I feel safe to wanting to be near my home. Mm. You could quantify it. It was that. I wasn't surprised with that finding, but I was surprised how you could quantify. Mm. Yeah, so some of that work has gone into planning of where to put facilities or actually, sadly, which ones to close, which is... When we do research, the sad fact I learnt out is sometimes people use it to do things you don't like.
Yes. Yeah.
And that was very confronting. For me, that people were using my research to close those primary units, because I'm a big fan of primary birthing, home, yep, or primary units. And, I was asked to be involved in the process as well, and then I kind of backed out because I felt there was decisions had been made anyway.
Yep.
So it was really... one of the interesting things about your research, that when you go into it, you don't necessarily think that's going to happen. That people could take it the wrong way.
and that's it. When you look at some of the medical research that's kind of gone on, I think it's gone off on one direction. And the thing that comes to my mind is cloning. And we kind of go off on that, but it can go off. But then you've got other people that just take it in a completely warped way.
Yeah.
And you sit there and go, but why did it go off in that way? It didn't need to. That's doing harm. That's not doing good.
Yeah, but even with an amid wifery, I mean, we remember hands off the breech, and now we're like, well, we didn't mean it quite like that. Susan, we were taught this, and then they're going, well, actually, that's not what we really mean. So, I mean, I imagine those researchers probably feel very much the same way. And that's huge. You know, that's stuff that had international impact. So.
Oh, absolutely. And those kind of, some of those big studies which we are now looking back on and kind of completely going, nah. We're changing practice completely.
Well, I think that's the other thing, is things evolve.
Yeah.
You know, things change. Like somebody quoted a study to me the other day that was done back in 2014, and they're going, oh, everybody's doing this. I said, no, they're not anymore. That study was done, and now we've changed our practice, and isn't that awesome? And they're going, oh, I suppose it is 7 years ago.
And that's, it is, so much is coming out, which is brilliant. It's feeling quite overwhelmed to try and keep up with it all, which is where, especially in academia, trying to review everything so that you're teaching the latest stuff. But then when you kind of go out, overwhelmed to try and keep up with it all, which is where, especially in academia, trying to review everything so that you're teaching the latest stuff. But then when you kind of go out, the students are saying, oh, this is what we're being taught. And sometimes the venues haven't quite caught up or it hasn't kind of rolled out yet through the different layers of bureaucracy. And so you can understand why students in particular are kind of coming out, oh, but we've just talked about this. Oh, but that's not happening. We're not doing it this way. And that confusion kind of, that stress can come in.
Yeah. I actually do a bit of work with my students. I mean, I teach at a medical school, so I'm teaching medical students. and I try to teach them that you will read this guideline and it says this, and you will go into the hospital and they'll be doing something completely different.
Yep.
And that's really confusing for you, but that's how it is. And I try to talk them through sitting with that and how to process that, because it can be really confronting. Yeah. And it's not necessarily that we've taught them, well, we do teach them the latest stuff and evidence-based practice, but teaching them how to cope with going out there and seeing something completely different. Yeah. So, yeah, and dealing with uncertainty, and I'm sorry, this is a bit of medical, but they tend to be very hooked up on needing to know things, yes, no,
yep,
certainty. And I said, well, welcome to maternity. Not like that.
I know. I think that's a common feeling with a lot of people, because there's that safety in that certainty.
Mm.
There's with that uncertainty, if you're not really sure, and like we've got these supposedly kind of evidence-based practice, and yet every country you go to, every hospital you go to, every venue you go to, there's slight modifications. And you go, but if we're doing evidence-based, then shouldn't everyone be doing the same? But we're all at different rollouts of it.
Yeah, because in reality, that's what it is. It's like it informs the choices people make. And I think that's less strong than based.
Well, when you think about what is, especially within some of the medical, and you're looking at evidence-based, which is a strongly medical focus originally, that RCTs are the gold standard. And there's been interesting, I follow Trish Greenhow on Twitter, and I adore him. I am a big fan girl of hers. And she's kind of like, yeah, evidence-based practice, and I do like my RCTs, but we also have to think about the other evidence and the quality of the other evidence that's actually the information that's giving us, because you can't do RCTs on everything.
No, you can't.
And when you look at a lot of the guidelines that you've got are consensus-based. They're
not
evidence.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. And I think that can be quite difficult for some people. I think some people who have got a bit of life experience on board perhaps cope with it a wee bit better, you know? So, but I mean, it's difficult. Synthesizing research is very difficult, but it's never ending, and we keep growing and learning. And what we learnt 5 years ago is not what, you know, we've learnt other stuff now. And
if we didn't keep growing, we'd still be doing CPR by rolling a barrel, like by rolling somebody over a barrel, or by putting a bellows up their bottom to try and breathe life into them. So we need to keep advancing our knowledge.
And I often pose the students a question, and I go, oh, we do this and we do this, and I say, well, why do you think they do that, and what's the evidence behind that? And they go, I don't know, you tell us. I say, well, there isn't actually very many, we just do that. Or we don't just do that. And, again, it can be quite confronting when that. And they go, I don't know, you tell us. I said, well, there isn't actually very many, we just do that. Or we don't just do that. And, again, it can be quite confronting.
Mm. So how did you, as a midwife, how did you get into teaching medical students then? Because it's a great pathway. We need midwives everywhere. But how did you get into that way?
I was working. When I moved south, after my kids were a bit older, and interestingly, along the way, I worked in a rest home.
Okay.
just as a carer, which is very similar to midwifery, actually, I have to say. And also, the lovely ladies at the rest home used to love being looked after by a midwife because they thought it was hilarious. But anyway, my kids got a bit older, and I went to work at the tertiary hospital in Dunedin, and I became very interested in audit. Of what was going on, and I became interested in research, and I got invited to become a research midwife, and I was very much encouraged by my medical colleagues to keep doing the research. and I did my master's while I was working on the wards and doing the research, and then I decided that I liked academia, and I dipped my toe in that pond a little bit in the midwifery school in Wellington at the postgrad school. But I decided I'd go for it and do a PhD and pursue academia, and I was, I guess it was being in the right place that I was, I got a scholarship from the medical school to my do my PhD.
Oh, fabulous.
And I had support to do teaching within their medical program as a little bit while I was doing that, as well as support their research. I did some really interesting studies with the medical research. I did some really interesting studies with the medical people. One of them, the head of department at the time, was doing a recovery after first caesareans to do with neuropathic nerve damage.
Yep.
And we followed women up for 2 years following a caesarean to see how the healing was going and how many people the pain didn't go away, or how many people developed neuropathic pain. And that was absolutely... It was really interesting. Gained a little bit of sort of side information, because I'm a midwife, I have to talk to people. And there was a thing about that a lot of women were very concerned about the cosmetic appearance of their caesarean scar, and a lot of them were off-centred.
Oh.
And it was everyone kept saying, it's not in the middle. And I reported this finding, which was totally not what we were looking for, but I just, as an anecdotal finding, to my HOD, and we tried to look into why they were all off-centre, and it's because the table's tipped in the operating theatre.
Of course. Of course.
And it's completely anecdotal. It wasn't part of the study. It was just one of those, hey, surgeons, registrars, when you're doing your incision, you've got a tipped table.
Start higher up a little bit.
So,
yeah.
But you're not supposed to do that with studies, are you? But it's a little bit of anecdotal. It was very important to the women.
But it is quite often, it's that ancillary stuff that comes out that can lead to other things.
Yeah.
Ancillary stuff that comes out that can lead to other things.
Yeah.
And because you're talking about that, having those conversations is that human side of it. And so that could lead to somebody doing an even bigger study on it and looking at it, because we know body image is huge. We know the caesarean scar, that recovery has a huge impact on mental health with a lot of women.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, the medical, they hadn't really considered that as even a secondary finding. They hadn't thought about that. Because they were interested in nerve, you know, they're nerve surgeons, and that's what they were interested in. So interesting, and I think as a midwife, you have those conversations, and you're following somebody for 2 years, and you're seeing your baby grow up, and they're having other babies, and it was lovely.
Sounds like a perfect honours student project, actually. You've got the documentation
and you're seeing your baby grow up, and they're having other babies, and it was lovely.
Sounds like a perfect honours student project, actually. You've got the documentation and the transcript.
Oh, I'd love to. I mean, there was other things that came out of it too. Like I think we've got a wee bit of a gap as far as maternal mental health after discharge, between when the midwife, because midwives here look after women to 4 to 6 weeks postpartum, and then we hand over to a well child provider.
Yep.
And I think as far as postnatal depression, there's a bit of a gap somewhere along the line after those 4 to 6 weeks of around 3 to 6 months, if depression's going to kick in, who's looking out for it?
Yeah.
At that time, is the woman actually going to go see her GP if she's not up to it? And because I was following these women at 3 and 6 months, and a year and 2 years, however, I really think, as an aside, and so now, I mean, that, there you go, there's another study. That's something I actually have a strong interest in pursuing in the future, is because we have a terrible maternal mortality rate of suicide here. It's the biggest cause of maternal mortality is suicide.
In one of your papers.
Yeah.
That was published. Now let me get back in to look at this one, because that's got the MM rate. So this is the paper, and I'll link on to kind of your profile, which has them on. So this is a 2019 paper.
Yeah.
Barriers to Equitable Maternal Health in Aotearoa.
Yeah.
Aotearoa. New Zealand, an integrative review. And then you looked at the overall mortality rate was something like 15, but then when you look at the Māori rate of 26.3, the Pacific Islander women's 23 compared to 6.3, the Pacific Islander women's 23 compared to European 13, and even the other Asians
yeah.
were down to 11.
Yeah. Yeah, but of the mortality, that suicide is the biggest one. And of those suicides, half of them are Māori.
So is that in that first 12 months or in the first 6 months?
Now this is what I want to look at, because
right.
in the reports that data came from is the perinatal
yep.
and maternal mortality committee. They only collect data to 42 days postpartum.
Wow, so that's
so it's in pregnancy, so any yep. pregnant woman into 42 days postpartum. And what I want to do is look, this is one of my many, many projects that I would like to do.
Yeah.
Is look at what are those rates 42 days to 1 year.
Yeah.
Because that data to birth, so they don't go how many of these people that committed suicide in this period had a baby in the last year.
Would you be able to match up the data sets though?
Oh, absolutely.
That data set would actually have yeah. that information in?
Oh, yeah. It would be... From the work I've done now, it would not be a difficult thing to do.
Which brings you back to that IT that you were working in beforehand, that big data set of being able to manipulate those, kind of correctly manipulate the
yeah.
big data sets to actually get out the information that you need.
Absolutely. But that is something, because that data is pregnancy in up to 42 days, and we all know
yep.
that postpartum depression is most commonly after that. I mean, antepartum depression is, you know, collected. I actually work for that committee now. I worked on their epidemiology team and their data analysis team to produce those reports now, but I wasn't doing it when I was doing the team. To produce those reports now, but I wasn't doing it when I was doing my PhD, but I've sort of slotted over to help them now. So.
But that's also an idea of how you can change after your PhD.
Oh,
if you get involved in something, you get to use it, you get an understanding, and then you can kind of move in different ways and become involved in different things.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's an evolving process as well. We're looking at, the committees are looking at what other questions could we ask, what are the kind of things we're not asking at the moment. And because I know the big data sets really well, I can go, well, without doing too much, we could find this out or that out. Without collecting extra information. So I think actually we undercount maternal suicide, but with the WHO definition, it isn't counted after 42 days anyway. So
it's a very tight definition, because when you're looking at the postnatal depression, they don't count it within postnatal depression. But then you've got puerperal psychosis that is also within that 10-day period.
Mm.
And so it's all like whose responsibility of it. And then some places, I know some private hospitals, some obstetricians are not doing postnatal kind of screening afterwards at all, and yet they're recommended to do it both pre and post, and to do it from day week two and week four postnatal.
Yeah. Well, we have a government contract that dictates what you have to do for postnatal care, and some sort of screening is you have to do it. Well, it's recommended. If you get audited, I guess that's the only way they'd actually know if you were doing it or not. But because of these statistics, they're so awful. They're terrible. But then there's some other research. There's some really interesting qualitative research out, and particularly with Māori and Pacifica women, about actually where you asked. But then there's some other research. There's some really interesting qualitative research out, and particularly with Māori and Pacifica women, about actually where you asked in an appropriate way,
yep.
where you asked in a way that you were comfortable discussing. So even if we are screening, are we doing it in an appropriate manner?
There are a lot of women who have stated that they don't give true answers because they don't want to risk their baby being taken away or being labelled. And so you sit there and go, okay, well, question 10 is obviously the suicide. Do you have any risk and things? But is there, how do we take the stigma? I mean, we've still got the stigma around mental health. How do we take that stigma away so that they actually are feeling safe enough to give us real answers? Continuity obviously helps with that because you have that relationship, but still.
Yeah, I think continuity really does help. I think when the continuity stops, you run into trouble.
Yeah.
And when the continuity stops, you run into trouble.
Yeah.
And also the pressures of the system perhaps mean that we're not seeing people as often as we used to postnatally, which is, makes me a bit sad, but that's just how it is. And do we really have the relationships? In New Zealand, we have that partnership model that we're working in partnership, which is open to critique about actually partnership is part, of course, in New Zealand, we have the Tiriti of Waitangi as well, and we are supposed to be working in partnership with the Indigenous peoples. And it's like, actually, there's this big power and imbalance, and actually, are we ever really working in partnership with anybody? And I don't necessarily think everyone is aware or cognizant of that power imbalance at all times. And are we really working in partnership? But I tend to critique things.
I've spoken to a few Kiwi midwives and I think I've got similar feelings. And
like anything, it doesn't always work.
And is it bringing it back? Like, there's a lot of conversation happening now around decolonisation of midwifery and in particular the academic of curriculums and stuff like that. And when we look at it both within the Maoris and obviously you've got the treaty in Australia, we never have a treaty, that in all of the countries they've got Indigenous populations, that there's always this imbalance no matter how much we try. And so how much of that relates back to that colonisation and the after effects of that?
Well, I think that is actually in New Zealand, in Aotearoa, that is the fundamental issue. There's so much of what we're dealing with, I was going to say in health inequities, but with inequities generally, is the after effects. And actually, I call it ongoing colonisation because I don't think it stopped.
No.
And there's the, I love the quote, Aboriginal Torres Strait Island woman, and I can't remember her name, but she hated the term post-colonialism. And she said, oh, nobody told me they'd gone.
haven't gone yet.
So I call it late colonialism. What we're in is late colonialism, and it's not the after effects, it's the ongoing issues. I am absolutely certain of that because we've got intergenerational trauma.
Yep.
We've got hideous statistics which show us again and again and again the outcomes for Māori, but in New Zealand we also have a huge, large Pacific population, and they are here as a result of colonisation.
Yep.
And actually we've got a big South Asian population as well, and actually you could say that they're in New Zealand because of colonisation as well, and unfortunately our stats are very poor for those women as well. Mm. And they're South Indian origin women, not from the continent but from Fiji. So I just think it underpins, and I've actually developed a model of what a research-based model of what I think underpins inequity in outcomes in New Zealand.
And that's your structural equation modelling?
That was my other paper. The first paper I did an integrated review of all the factors.
That's right. That was geographic, political, maternal care, cultural, colonisation, acceptability.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Acceptability is a really important one because when people think of access being a problem with equity, they tend to think of physical access, like where is this service in relation to the people, and you get the most services are where the people that least need them are, which is absolutely true. You know, it's an old care law, but it's absolutely true. But it's not just physical. Is the service cost effective? Like, can people afford it? Is it acceptable? Is it culturally acceptable? Is it a place you can take your kids? Is it, you know, so there's a whole range of aspects of access that aren't just geographical.
Mm.
And I think that's something we need to keep a grip on. That's why I separated them out in my model.
Was this part of your PhD or a separate?
Absolutely, no.
PhD, yeah.
So when I did my PhD, I did a hybrid model. So a few of the chapters are publications, and then there's some non-publication chapters as well. So, my PhD is on the inequity and maternity outcomes in Aotearoa, New Zealand. This is when I say I owe the debt to that community for all of my bungling. Well, not only, but it's like it's a social justice issue, and it is just not okay. Now, in New Zealand, there's two conversations. It's not okay from a legal, from a treaty point of view that Māori do worse. That's absolutely unacceptable on many levels. But in a bigger way of thinking, it's not okay for anybody to do worse all the time, you know? And I started looking at social determinants. Again, there's some interesting theories around that the healthcare itself is only probably about 20 to 30% of a person's overall health.
Mm.
You know, what we can do as midwives, doctors, healthcareers, whatever, nurses.
Is
only such a small amount, and I think we credit ourselves a bit much sometimes. We get in, I don't know, we want to go in and fix everything, and actually.
We are fixers. And I think
we are fixers.
When you look at the Sustainable Development Goals, and you really look at how they've changed from the Millennial Goals to the Sustainable Development Goals, and healthcare now comes underneath one, but when you look at what they are, and it is, it's the poverty, it's the environmental stuff, it's access to equality, it's kind of gender equality. There are those broader issues that are the true umbrellas that affect everyone's individual lives in multiple ways.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, that's the core of the difference between equality and equity. Like, equality is giving everybody the same opportunity.
Yeah.
But the thing is, because of the social determinants, not everybody has the capability of taking advantage of those opportunities that are presented. And there's some really interesting capability theory. And the social determinants are the things that prevent that capability from privileges that are presented. From person A and person B being able to take advantage of opportunities. Now, it could be distrust of this. We're seeing that in COVID vaccination. Mm. Actually, sorry to bring it up, but people,
you can't not bring it up because it's highlighted so much in the last 2 years.
Because I keep having conversations with people and they're going, why are these people getting vaccinated? I said, they don't trust the system. They don't trust this white person coming into their community with a needle of God knows what. You know, there's no trust. They've had dealings with the welfare system. They've had dealings with child welfare. They've had dealings with possibly prisons, police, government things in a very negative way. So why on earth would they trust a health professional?
Papua New Guinea this week has just had some massive protests in Port Moresby against vaccinations because of that, quite possibly, that kind of thing.
Why would we trust you? I mean, that might be stretching it a bit much, but I'm just saying that I don't think every healthcarer understands that. Although we have been told and told and told by Indigenous people and Indigenous academics and Indigenous healthcarers, we've been told this forever. Mm. And now they're going, oh, you know. It's so frustrating. I mean, there's even research since the Commission on Social Determinants of Health that came out, it's over 10 years ago now, and yet the research that's been done since then, only a tiny amount of it has been translational research.
Yep.
They just keep describing the problems and describing the problems. And to be honest, I did a bit of that in my PhD, but there's no... Well, what are we going to do about it? Which actually, I also think research, that's really, really important. I was telling my students today about writing papers, and they go, oh, we hate writing papers, we hate doing presentations. What's the point of research if you don't do that? What's the point in finding out about something if you don't tell anybody?
Yeah. And that's it, so, that dissemination of information sparks somebody else to change practice. And that's ultimately what we want, is we want that change practice. But unless we're given it to us in a way that we can understand the rationale and then the consequences, it's, we're never going to change that practice.
Yeah, and I actually think that we need to, and actually the Health Research Council here is starting to fund more action research, translation research, implementation research, which is great, because actually that's what we need to do now, is actually get this stuff out and get it going and get it working. Yeah.
Get it out there. Yeah. So what else kind of surprised you from your PhD?
Because actually that's what we need to do now, is actually get this stuff out and get it going and get it working. Yeah.
Get it out there. So yeah. What else kind of surprised you from your PhD then?
I looked at a range of social determinants that and I looked at the correlations between poor outcomes. Now, I looked at maternal outcomes and perinatal outcomes. I looked at mortality and morbidity, because a lot of studies have been done just looking at one thing, either just maternity or just perinatal, but actually you've got a family here. And if your mum's sick in ICU, then it affects everybody. If the baby dies, it affects everybody. It's like, I don't think you can separate it out. Anyway, it makes it really hard to compare to other studies, but anyway. I think there was some social determinants that the outcomes were slightly better for a certain set of people, because
they got fed.
There's food and housing, and they weren't necessarily healthcare. They actually got healthcare.
Yeah.
They possibly, in this speculation, perhaps they were not exposed to as much violence, maybe, maybe not.
Well.
So that was one. But when I thought about it, it was only for one very specific outcome.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, actually, that kind of makes sense, but isn't that really sad? A lot of the social determinants were complete. Insecure housing, you know, significantly correlated. Family violence, you know, intimate partner violence correlated, particularly with perinatal outcomes. That, you know, they were all predictable. That there was things like ever having registered with a family doctor or GP practice, was protective.
Mm.
And I was trying to think, well, what's that? And we think maybe it's just a proxy for engagement with the system.
Maybe stability in that area.
Well, this is ever.
Yeah.
Like ever in their life.
Ever in their life. Yeah.
So we think it's just, well, they've engaged with the system.
It almost, you could almost bring it right back down to Maslow's again, couldn't you?
Absolutely, yeah.
And take it right back to that safety level and that kind of shelter food before you can actually do any of the higher levels of self-actualization.
Yeah. So there was 19 determinants, and some of them were sort of dictated what I could get.
Yeah.
Like poverty was quite a difficult one, because the other thing I tried to do was find out what was going on at the time of the birth.
Mm.
Not from the census, because the census could be 5 years either way. So when this baby was born, what was going on? So I looked at, was this person on a government benefit?
Yep.
At the time of the birth, and at the time of the birth, had they had more than three house shifts in the year of the birth, you know, that kind of thing. So they weren't very surprising, really. And I think we think some of them came up were a bit odd. We think they're just proxies for other things, but you'd actually have to go back and look at the individual determinant and break it. They were very high level, like a lot of them were just binary. Is this a thing or isn't it? Like, do you have a current driver's license? Yes, no. We pulled that out, and that was highly protective, but we think it's a proxy again for education or whatever, that somebody's got the money to get their drug, because it's quite expensive.
Yeah.
You know, so we think it's a proxy that somebody having a current driver's license, although there is research from Australia that in Aboriginal communities, if you have a driver's license, you do way better. So I know there's something going on, but I think that was the interesting thing to me, that this is a very high-level look. It's a fly-past that these 19 things, just about all of them were significant. This is a very high-level look. It's a fly-past that these 19 things, just about all of them were significantly, statistically significantly related to poor outcomes or protective of.
Yeah.
not many were surprising, but I think it, you know, there's 19 studies, you could go look at each one and break them down further. Like I said, it was very high level. And we looked at some of the health ones too, like high use of ED.
Yeah.
That really highly correlated with poor outcomes. And you could say, oh, well, they're sick, so they're there all the time. So that's not surprising. But if you look at the research around presentations to ED, it's not always why people turn up there.
No.
Yeah, it can be an access issue, a cost issue, people not understanding how sick they are or how sick they aren't, you know, that kind of thing. It can be transitory family, and it's a bit worrying actually that I was very concerned that it could be stigmatizing. And you know, I look at all these useless people with all these poor outcomes, but actually I've got a whole chapter on kind of a full Foucauldian analysis of power and control why these things stay in place, because what I described is pretty much the same anywhere else in the world, and it's also the same as it was 20 years ago. I found a report that the things I found they were worried about in 1999. So why yeah. If we know that if we gave everybody a good house and good food and good income, they'd be healthier, and then that'd cost the health system less, if you want to be country about it. So why aren't we doing anything? And so I had a wee look at that as well from a Foucauldian perspective.
How does that then relate to the political systems that we have? Because we've got political systems that get voted in and out every 3 to 4 years. They have to show they've made a difference in spending their money, whichever way they do it. When you try and get somebody in who does generational change, which is what this needs, they don't last long because they get voted out.
Well, I have a theory, which I explored in my thesis.
Need to publish this chapter?
This chapter will be, I'm just finishing my quantitative paper, and then I'm going to write my full code.
Excellent.
Governmentality is when we govern each other. And when you have middle centrist governments, because in New Zealand we have left and right, but they're fairly centrist,
You're
never going to get any change. You're never going to get any big sweeping change. And so if your government's centrist and all this stuff is happening to other people, it's very easy not to do anything. And in New Zealand, I'm convinced it comes from the neoliberal policies of the 80s. And like I said, we're in late colonialism. Well, New Zealand is in late neoliberalism. We have not moved on from it. We are still at that pull your socks up. It's your fault, that individual responsibility, not collective responsibility. And that has to change. And I don't see any political will for that to change, because all these things happen to other people. And that, you know, the people that believe in trickle-down theory aren't at the bottom. They're the people either at the top or in the middle who are getting some benefit.
COVID's proven that.
Absolutely.
Perfect example of the world being in, like, we're sitting here promoting in Australia, we're sitting here promoting booster shots, the third shot. There are still so many countries that haven't been promoting in Australia, we're sitting here promoting booster shots, the third shot. There are still so many countries that have never got their first shots done yet because of a variety of reasons. But you sit there and kind of go, I think Australia and New Zealand, and whilst we kind of want to adopt Jacinta because she's absolute power load over better than what Morrison is, and Morrison, he's just an embarrassment. But when you look at us and you look at the UK, you look at America, it is the same. It's that kind of that same principle, especially with Trump here. But we need massive change, but the people aren't ready for it to back it, because it's going to cost them and they're not willing to pay for it.
Yeah. And I mean, it comes back to, I'm a bit of a fan of Michael Marmot's work in the health gap.
Yep. And the
countries that have the biggest wealth gap, like there's the very poor and the very rich, which our gap's getting bigger here. The health gap. And the countries that have the biggest wealth gap, like there's the very poor and the very rich, which our gap's getting bigger here. The health gap is bigger.
Yes.
And on the political, you were talking about that, you know, that this never generational change. I was absolutely privileged to have a workshop, a one-on-one work mastery workshop with Michael Marmot a few years ago. It was one of those things you had to apply for, and there was like 10 people, and I thought, right, I'm just going to go for Michael Marmot, and if I get in. And so there was three of us, and we all got 20 minutes, and we could ask so many questions. I'll send you the photo.
Yeah, thank you.
I totally went fangirl and got him to sign my book. But I have to say, I asked him about this. We have a three-year election cycle, and I said, what do you do with that? How do you actually ever get anything done when you've got a three-year election cycle and it's flip-flop, flip-flop, not the party, but the people who want to do the right thing, and you go in and you help them do the right thing. Don't back a party, back the people who will get it stuck in. Now, I think there are people in New Zealand who want to do work about poverty, and so we need to back those people and not back, oh, I'll just vote left, because actually it's not really left. And I was put in a very challenging situation a little bit after that, and a person to the political right was wanting to do a really good thing for his community.
Yeah.
and I helped him. And I remember meeting him for a coffee for the first time, and I said, look, I'm really sorry, I'm a socialist. But he wanted to do a good thing for his community, even though our politics were not aligned. And I never would have had that in his community, even though our politics were not aligned. And I never would have had that meeting if it hadn't been for what Michael Marmot said to me. And we worked together with some discomfort, but we worked together on that issue. And I think, having done it, I think that is the way forward. And I was... because everybody asked that question, I thought, right, I've got Michael Marmot here in front of me, and I'm asking.
And party politics is one of the biggest dangers, I think, because it is an idealism. It's not actually looking at reality. And they will just go, we're following party line and we're following orders, and not actually looking at the evidence and not looking at what they can do. And we see it all the time with voting in different ways. And you sit there and kind of go, oh, but they haven't given me this. It's like, you want this little thing, but when you look at the greater cause, oh, I believe in that, but no, I'm not doing it because of the parties going against it. And he sits there, and they've got, you're actually there for the people. You should be voting for the people, not for the party. And party politics annoys the hell out of me.
And I think that's what those people, if they do want to do something outside the centre, it's really hard for them.
Yeah.
So they need us to back them, because they might not get backing within their party.
Yeah.
So if we back them, I mean, it's worth a go.
Well, we're seeing more people step up. We're seeing more people come and step up to change. And we're seeing more independents step up. We've got some independents here that I really quite follow. I don't agree with everything they say, but there are some kind of ideas that they've got, which I go, yeah, I'm fully behind you in that, because that's the right thing to do. That's not looking at who kind of comes out the winner. It's actually the right for the end product people, and especially with some things like veterans and maternity issues. You're sitting there going, no, it's not about, it's about the end product. It's about the, you're sitting there going, no, it's not about, it's about the end product. It's about the women's safety. It's about veterans' health and decreasing suicide. It's, that's who you pay attention to, not the kind of the politics and what they get out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult thing. It's always going to be a difficult thing. And the people that do worst are always going to be the others.
Mm.
They're always going to be the people that we police as a society. I quite like some of Che Guevara's writing, because he was a doctor and he worked in health and he was the gorilla, but, you know. He said that actually your neighbour's health is your problem.
Yeah.
And that's obviously a very socialist way of looking at it, but we are so far removed from that. You know, we're just completely removed from that.
Cuba is one of the countries that in most internet, yet they're kind of blocked off from America. There's so many kind of politics, but they have that point of view, is we're here to actually serve to others. And so we can share our knowledge and share our experience.
Yeah. So it's absolutely, I mean, obviously there are huge problems.
Yep.
You know, it's not an ideal, but I don't, if we really are committed to resolving inequity, that's the kind of thinking we need. And the way I think is, when I keep saying it's others, it's those other people. So what we have to do is get those other people in charge.
Yeah.
And there's a saying here, and it's like, what works for everyone may not work for Māori, but what works for Māori probably will work for everyone. And actually what I want to see is the people who are currently other, if you want to use that, if they're in charge and not just a tick box on a committee, you know, oh yeah, we've got representation, but if they're actually in charge and currently other, if you want to use that, if they're in charge and not just a tick box on a committee, you know, oh yeah, we've got representation, but if they're actually in charge, and actually you can see this happening with COVID as well, that's when it works. That's when all that stuff falls away. So I have a belief in that as well, and I think we're slowly seeing that in government, very slowly, and even in healthcare we're starting to see it here, but I think we're still a wee bit stuck to tokenism. But I you know, time.
And it has to be real representation. You need to be at the table. Same as we want midwives at every table where decisions made. You don't. You're not there just as a token. You're there as a voice that they're listening to.
Yeah. Well, that's a huge advantage we have here. We are ahead midwifery wise, but we're seeing cracks in that as well, because we always say, "Oh, continuity of care fixes all these things." Which, and you know, the research says back to the fact that it's that. Oh, we think we can fix everything, but we're only a bit of the equation. You know, you've got this great continuity of care midwife, but you live in your car. You know?
Yeah, exactly. So what would the rates be if you didn't have continuity of care? That's the frightening thing.
Well, that is something I I went to Ireland and presented at a conference. Said, you know, you're saying to us, oh, your model is wonderful, we want to do what you do. And I said, but, you know, we've still got our issues.
Yeah.
I know we're not supposed to say that, but what would it look like? Because that second paper, that structural equation modelling, was looking at equity of experience. And most of the women in that study had midwifery care, but they still weren't getting equal experience. Mm. So young women, rural women, Māori and Pacifica didn't really come up in that, but the response rates were incredibly low for that survey. But again, they've all got continuity.
Yep.
But they're not getting equal experience, and I think that's fascinating. I don't focus very much on midwives. My research is more about what's happening for the people at the end, the mums and babies, the parents, the families. I am not one of those people, because of the system we're in, I'm not going, well, if you have GP care or obstetric care or midwife care, what's the difference? Because actually their numbers aren't big enough to actually look at that. So it's we all roughly have the same equal opportunity for care here, but I don't think it's equitable.
No.
And I think that's part of that acceptability, and it also goes back to what we're talking about having a midwife that you can really have that partnership with, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I think our system's pretty good and we're really lucky. And when I went to Ireland, I thought, we're really lucky.
Yeah.
Although I had the privilege of talking to the midwives running the Māmi study over there, who have total patient, what they call patient participation as part of their, like, the study is designed with the women.
Yep.
And when they present their data, the women get up and present it. It's them. It's about them. It's for them. They are so involved. And honestly, if you're looking for a model of research with actual real participation, not just, I've got a consumer on my panel, but actual people involved, that study is absolutely.
And that should be the basis for every study that we do. If we're looking at whatever consumer group we're looking at, they should be part of the whole process.
Yeah. While I was over there, I actually went to a workshop about that, because in the EU, every research application has to have that now.
Yep.
You have to have, and And one of the consumers I was actually talking to, and he says, oh, yeah, it sounds all very good. It is still a bit tick box sometimes, but mostly it's not now. Mostly, like the workshop example was, they wanted to do some research about autistic people. So they actually got a whole bunch of autistic people together. So, and it was really hard because they're saying how difficult that was to facilitate. And then the information they got from the parents was completely different from the actual people themselves. But before they did their study, that's what they did. And then they kept referring back to this group. And being autism, it was very difficult.
Yeah.
But they did it. And it was amazing. And the people valued that research because they'd been part of it, you know. And it was, I'm starting to work up my next proposal at the moment, and that's how I want to do it.
Yeah.
And I'm just starting to do. But when you go just to get the community participation, and they go, what? And I said, you've got to do it authentically. In COVID, even, you've got to do it face-to-face because of cultural issues, but you've still got to do it because it's not going to work over Zoom. And and it's something that here is really hard to get past funders. But like I said, with those EU applications, you have to do it. It's just part of it. It's PPI. It's brilliant.
I think it's a matter of time.
Yeah.
It's a matter of time until it comes to all of us.
And I mean, I did see the perfect side of it because obviously when people are presenting at conferences, they don't tell you about the disasters. But I was just so excited. And the mummy study was just, you know, they just all, what's the most important thing to you?
Mm.
You know, and one of the things that came up was incontinence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, yeah, we just deal with that. And it's like, no, this is like really, really important to us. This is the slow. Nobody talks about this. Nobody gives us the help. Now all the women get physio.
Yep.
Well, I mean, it depends who you are. But that was one of the things that came up that hadn't necessarily been prioritised as a research priority for that group. It's like, oh, that's just one of the things that happens. And it's like, no, this is really important.
Yeah.
It's like my caesarean scar thing.
Yep.
It's like, no, this is really important to us.
And I think that's where the future research is going to be really interesting, is it's what we think is of as researchers and academics, and from this side of it, we're interested in certain things, but it may not be at all related to what the women want, or what the families want, or what the partners want. And then you sit there and ask them, it's like, what are you worried about? And it's like, I'm really worried about what I actually do during the birth. Like, how do I help? And you sit there and kind of, but that's not, but it is important because that's their relationship, it's their bonding, it's their attachment, it's that whole process, which we know has intergenerational effects, because if you don't have that safety, that bonding, attachment in that stage, it affects your relationships with everyone else for the rest of your life, and also your children in the future.
Yeah. But also the reason I'm trying to get this community work happening, and I again am kind of modelling it on that study I saw in Ireland at Trinity, is because I want to look at what makes people well.
Yeah.
Because I have been very deficit focused, because the data about deficit is really easy to find. Really easy to find death data.
Yeah.
Really easy to find bad data, and it gets back into that stigmatisation thing. So now I want to look at what are the well-being factors, what are the things that make people well, and conversely, what are good outcomes? Because a good outcome isn't necessarily the absence of a bad one.
Absolutely. Now I'm just trying to pull up my Diane Minaj. And she actually asked women, what is, it is, let me tell you, and I can tell you what podcast number it is. It is podcast number episode 22.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually asked women, what is compassionate midwifery care? Because she wanted that kind of, what is the positive?
To look at
the positive. And so she asked them, what, tell me, she didn't kind of define what compassion was. She just says, tell me what compassionate midwifery was. And it was that, within 2 seconds of a midwife being in the room, you know if they're there with you or if they're still ticking boxes, and that kind of that interaction. So she wants the same thing. She wanted to look at the good, the positive of it, and find out what it was.
Because, I mean, I've done 3 years of negatives, and now I want to look at the well-being.
Yeah.
Again, funders don't seem to be particularly interested, but anyway, we're getting there. Because, I mean, I've done 3 years of negatives, and now I want to look at the well-being.
Yeah.
Again, funders don't seem to be particularly interested, but anyway, we're getting there. Because what I think might be well-being might not be there, so I have to go and ask.
So because you were focused so much on kind of negative sides and aspects of it, perfect segue to my question. How did you keep your mental health when you were doing this? How did you keep your balance when you're kind of focusing on so much of the negative?
Well, it was a really depressing thesis, to be honest. It was all about really bad things. It was severe morbidity and mortality. And there was two things. I knew I could never do it part-time because I had to have a run-up. That's just how I am. So I actually was doing it full-time, looking at these bad things. And it was total. I got very sick of debating these issues at the tea table. And, you know, there became jokes that instead of saying hi, Mum, when they got home from school, they'd yell intersectionality at me and things like that. And
how old are your kids now?
I've got three teenage daughters.
Okay, there you go. Yep.
Who seem to be completely overeducated in this area now. But I went through some really rough patches. I had the most amazing supervision team you could ever ask for. Just, you hear so many supervision disasters, but perfect. And a multidisciplinary team.
Yep.
I also used the university, the postgrad department had a coach, and Nikki helped me through some really tough times.
So which was Otago?
Otago University, yep. Yeah. So I think I found, because I was using really big data sets to do this, and it's in a strange secure lab, and you have to sign government secrecy agreements, and you're in there, and during COVID you're in there on your own, nobody else is in the building, and I find peace in numbers.
I get that, no. I can understand that, yep.
And I could just sink into the data, and then yep. I'd have to say every one of these numbers is a person, a mother or a baby or a family, to pull myself back out of it. But even now when I do data work, because I'm still employed to do a bit of it, it's like it's very calming for me. Now, I do understand that that's not for everybody. And I want to tell my fifth form maths teacher, who told me I'd never be any good at maths, I've now done a PhD, an epidemiology PhD, but I find it very calming. And it's just that kind of routine immersed. That's what got me through. But also, I had the greatest cheerleading team ever, with my family and friends and everybody I encountered who thought this was important work.
Yep.
Yeah.
What type of things did they do to help cheer you on, to help get you physically through it?
I think my main supervisor she's just so positive.
Yep.
And she kept talking me through things that she'd learnt, like about high energy days and low energy days. Like, she could talk to me on that kind of basis. So it's recognising what your strengths are and what you can do on day X, and if you're a type of person that works the deadlines or not. It's a grind. I'm not trying to put anyone off PhDs, but it's a hard work, and you've just got to find what works for you.
Yeah.
And during COVID, I just couldn't write. The first lockdown in 2020, and I just I got to this thing I couldn't write, and then our postgrad department at the university did Pomodoro sessions by Zoom.
Yep.
And you zoomed in, and there was like other PhD students, and we had half hour writing blocks, and we were just writing, but there were other people there doing exactly the same thing, and that got me out of that writing block. Yep. Was just connecting with other people doing the same thing, because I just got completely paralysed when I was in lockdown. So we zoomed in once a week, and we did, I think it was 2 hours, and we got work done. We all got work done, and we all talked about what was challenging and what we were finding hard. And actually on Twitter there was the thesis whisperer. And the midwifery PhD group and thesis whisperer. And the midwifery PhD group, and there's just all these people who are in the same boat cheering each other along, and I found that absolutely invaluable.
Cool. How did you celebrate?
I'm very lucky that Otago is a bit of a traditional institution place. When you hand in your thesis for examination, you get to ring a great big bell, like it's huge.
Oh, cool.
And they give you a big mallet and you bang this big bell. And they give you a chocolate fish, a Belgian chocolate fish. It's a New Zealand thing, a chocolate fish, but this is everybody that submits their thesis gets that. And the day I got my viva, I had my viva, and it was so stressful. And then I went out and had a Guinness.
Of course, best thing to celebrate with.
And because I quite liked that when I went to Ireland. And then when actual graduation, because we're not into...
Doesn't matter.
But it was what I loved doing.
And after 3 years of kind of deep soul stuff, that's what celebration should be.
Yeah. What I regret is not having a rest.
Right.
Because I took a job as soon as I handed it in,
and
I worked, it was quite intensive, and then I did my viva, I took time off to do that, and then I never really had a rest, and I would advise everybody to have a rest when it's over.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And because there's a certain amount of grief you've handed in, it's something, well, particularly full time, like that's your whole last, for me, it was just over 3 years of my life. Was over, and I didn't really realize how special. Well, somebody had told me, they said, a very senior person at the university had said, you know, Pauline, you'll never ever get to do your research and just your research. They realized how special. Well, somebody had told me, they said, a very senior person at the university had said, you know, Pauline, you'll never ever get to do your research and just your research for 3 years.
Yeah.
It's, he told me just to enjoy it, and I didn't really realise until I'd done, was done. So I think it's really important to celebrate. It's important to rest, and you might feel some grief. It's really normal.
So where to now?
I have lots of plans, and I've had a really intensive teaching year. I sort of got thrown in at the deep end, but it's been fun, and I'm finding my way, because as I said, I do teach in a medical school, and I've one of my colleagues has been away, and I've been teaching the final year medical students, so the ones, so you know, in 2 weeks I think they're going to be doctors. Here I really want to get back to my research, which is my love. I love teaching. Students are fantastic, and they give me this energy. And I've been supervising somebody as well, and they're just the energy is just amazing, but I want to get back to making a difference, because I became a midwife to make a difference, and I became a midwife to do something real and something tangible, and that's something I've drawn through into my research, that it has to be something that can be picked up and used. And so now I want to look at, well, you know, the more positive side of things. So yeah.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. It's been lovely chatting.
Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your graduate studies or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.